We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our goulash dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.
Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 24 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Through Wheat-Colored Glasses, which answers questions I've gotten about the podcast as it seeks to convey once more what an incredible crop our wheat crop is. But first, let's give ourselves a hand. Episode 24. Woo! I've got to admit, putting together a once-a-week 20-minute podcast with a staff of one has forced me to up my game. You might think talking would be a lot less taxing than writing, but there's still a lot of writing that happens, in addition to recording and editing, not to mention dealing with additional pieces of equipment. It's true, my implements aren't tractors, combines, bank-out wagons, or drills for seeding, but having one of them misbehave during a critical phase of the operation provides a similar level of frustration. Grrr. Speaking of which, I gave a presentation about the podcast to the Washington Grain Commission Board at their May meeting using website statistics showing how much more the website is being accessed since the advent of Wheat All About It. The statistics are impressive, but I warned commissioners that there are liars, damn liars, and statistics. Especially now in a world where centralized computers are constantly sending out bots to websites for good and ill purposes, it's unclear to me how much value there is in the actual numbers. I don't care whether a bot, a robot, toggled the switch which indicates a visit to a podcast. I care about whether wheat growers, landlords, and agribusinesses are listening to Wheat All About It. I do think you can glean from the numbers that the podcast is helping move website statistics in the right direction. For the first 4 months of 2017, visits to the WGC website are up 300% over the year before, new visits are up 600%, and return visits are up nearly 400%. I like what all of those numbers represent, but the return visits, that 400% increase, means people are finding something of value because they're coming back. Here's another statistic I'm fond of because it goes to the reason I started the podcast in the first place, which was for busy farmers to access information while they were doing something else, like driving the tractor or driving for parts. I've also heard from people who say the 20-minute podcast format is a perfect fit for a workout. In 2016, nearly all visits to the WGC website were made through Windows PCs, meaning whoever was looking was doing so sitting at their desks in front of their computers. In the first 4 months of 2017, after the weekly version of Wheat All About It was introduced, however, the use of iPhones to access the site has gone up 900%, and visits from Droid smartphones have gone up more than 400%. I'm glad people are still accessing the podcast through their computers. They are certainly ahead of those who aren't listening to the podcast at all. But don't forget the amazing power of the devices we carry in our pockets. And when I tell you all to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, you don't need to have an Apple device to get an iTunes account. iTunes accepts all comers. And once you have a subscription to Wheat All About It, it will be delivered to you weekly. Who knows? Perhaps you'll even use your account to buy that newly remixed version of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Can you believe it? 50 years since its release. For the record, the most listened to podcast so far has been episode 16, entitled Pay Attention, which included a segment interviewing Jay Penner on the farm accident that paralyzed him. The second most listened to podcast was episode 8, which was my interviews about low soil pH with several soil experts. And third on the list was episode 18, my interview with Matthew Weaver, who is not only the reporter for the Agricultural Weekly Capital Press in Eastern Washington, but also a produced playwright. I asked a farmer the other day whether he had been listening to the podcast. He said he had listened to a couple of them and they sounded real good. I should have been pleased, but I harassed him. A couple? Why aren't you listening to all of them? They're all good. His reply went to the heart of the difficulty of expanding listenership within a group of a certain age that is largely set in their ways. I'm just not in the habit, he said. I certainly understand that. Research suggests that on average it takes 66 days, depending on the behavior, the person, and the circumstances, to build a habit. One can argue this podcast hasn't even been around long enough to be habit-forming. But I certainly thank those of you listening now for making new habits. Congratulations! I've been asked by a few people about the songs you hear at the beginning and end of the podcast. There are six of them, and I rolled them out over several months. Yes, they were written by me, and yes, most of them are sung by me, although the best of the lot was sung by my daughter Chloe. I don't think of myself as a particularly good singer, but I did want something to separate this podcast from others. And as my millennial son-in-law put it, I don't know anybody doing a podcast who is singing his own theme songs. To me, the songs are really prose poems set to music. Although I didn't grow up on a farm, there are things you learn about wheat farmers and their industry after a close association with them for going on 32 years, and the poems reflect what I have learned. The musical instrumentation you hear isn't me. It comes courtesy the GarageBand program that I use to edit the podcasts. The music is what are called loops and are free for anyone to use. I have simply chosen the loop that I feel goes best with the beat and the words of the song. I'm particularly happy with the song called Special Treat, which Chloe sang at the beginning of this podcast. I didn't realize at the time I was writing the poem that I was capturing something essential about the crop and its importance to the planet. I hope you'll forgive my navel-gazing for the next few minutes, but I think it's worth our time to dissect the poem line by line. We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. Given the fact that wheat provides 20% of the world's calories, and for the poorest of the poor, 20% of their total protein, the essential role of wheat in the world today is as clear now as it was 20,000 years ago when our ancestors began picking the seeds out of heads of this unique grass to eat. It would be another almost 10,000 years before other ancestors figured out they could plant the seeds to reap a harvest. It was because of that harvest that hundreds of thousands of years of roaming by our Homo sapien hunter-gatherer forebears came to an end. Certainly, wheat is a miracle of nature. I can't get over the fact that scientists believe the weed goatgrass, which used to be a particular headache for farmers to kill in wheat crops before the advent of clear-field herbicide-resistant varieties, actually crossed with the plant that wound up becoming wheat, in the process providing it with the gluten-forming properties that make bread possible. There's a fellow by the name of Yuval Noah Harari who wrote a book entitled Simply Sapiens with the subtitle A Brief History of Humankind. In it, Harari suggests that it wasn't human beings, otherwise known as Homo sapiens, who tamed wheat, but that it was wheat which tamed us. As Harari puts it, 10,000 years ago, wheat was one of many wild grasses confined to a small range in the Middle East. Now it is growing all over the world, becoming one of the most successful plants in the history of the earth. How? According to Harari, it wasn't humans manipulating wheat. It was wheat manipulating humans. As he put it, quote, "This ape had been living a fairly comfortable life, hunting and gathering until about 10,000 years ago, but then began to invest more and more effort in cultivating wheat. Within a couple of millennia, humans in many parts of the world were doing little else from dusk to dawn other than taking care of wheat plants. It wasn't easy. Wheat demanded a lot of them. Wheat didn't like rocks and pebbles, so sapiens broke their backs clearing fields. Wheat didn't like sharing its space, water, and nutrients with other plants, so men and women labored long days weeding under the scorching sun. Wheat got sick, so Sapiens had to keep watch out for worms and blight. Wheat was attacked by rabbits and locust swarms, so the farmers built fences and stood guard over the fields. Wheat was thirsty, so humans dug irrigation canals or lugged heavy buckets from the well to water it. Sapiens even collected animal feces to nourish the ground in which the wheat grew. Harari said growing wheat was so hard and demanded so much time that people were forced to settle permanently next to their wheat fields, completely changing the hunter-gatherer existence practiced by Homo sapiens for hundreds of thousands of years. Or as he put it, "We did not domesticate wheat. It domesticated us." The word domesticate comes from the Latin domus, which means house. Who's the one living in the house? Not the wheat. It's the sapiens. Harari said wheat offers nothing to people in terms of individuals, but everything in terms of a species. Cultivating wheat provided much more food per unit of territory. That, in turn, enabled Homo sapiens to multiply exponentially. For instance, back when people fed themselves by gathering wild plants and hunting wild animals, Harari said an area around the oasis of Jericho in Palestine could support a roaming band of about 100 people. Around 8500 BC, when wild plants gave way to wheat fields, the oasis supported a village of 1,000. That represents success in terms of evolution. Or, as Harari put it, "The currency of evolution is neither hunger nor pain, but rather copies of DNA helixes. Just as the economic success of a company is measured only by the number of dollars in its bank account, not by the happiness of its employees, so the evolutionary success of a species is measured by the number of copies of its DNA. From such a perspective, 1,000 copies are always better than 100 copies," Harari said. In other words, the turn to agriculture provided the means to keep larger numbers of people alive, which in my book makes it a miracle. Back to the song, next line. "A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead." During the first attempt by Monsanto to introduce a GMO wheat in the early 2000s, while I was still a reporter, opponents to such a release, which included some farmers along with environmentalists, made much of the fact that wheat was different from corn or soybeans by virtue of it being mentioned in the Bible. In fact, it's mentioned more than 30 times if you include those instances where the word seed is implied to be wheat. In one biblical passage known as the Parable of Wheat and Weeds, Jesus compares the kingdom of heaven to a farmer who planted good seed in his field, but while he was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. There's meanwhile no doubt that wheat has filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Although per capita consumption of wheat in the U.S. is holding steady at around 133 pounds per capita, it should be growing with the population, and it's not, owing in part to carbohydrate-free diets and the gluten-free craze. But consider, back in 1880, when the people in this country didn't have as many food choices as we do today, that per capita consumption of wheat was pegged at more than 225 pounds, there was no obesity, and certainly no thought was given to wheat alternatives. Next line. "Through a history of misfortune and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough." Through my reading of history, the importance of wheat can't be overlooked. It's why, when you go on a walking tour of downtown Washington, D.C., among the buildings constructed when wheat was not taken for granted, you see instances of wheat carved, engraved, or painted on buildings. The crop fed us when there was nothing else, and America was grateful for it. Here's a great story to that point. Louis Davenport, renowned for helping build Spokane and the Davenport Hotel, got to the city just after the fire of 1889 had destroyed much of the town. The young Davenport, a bank teller from San Francisco, looked at the resources available and asked himself what he could do to make a buck. He purchased a tent, and using flour ground from wheat growing on surrounding farms, he made waffles for those who were suddenly homeless. That's right, Davenport had Spokane's first Waffle House. Is it possible to argue that without the foundation of success he built from it, that there would be no Davenport Hotel? I think so, but then I'm biased, aren't I? Next line. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. Let's imagine for a moment some virulent pest descended on the world's wheat crops, and within a couple of years, wheat had ceased to exist. There is no doubt in my mind that millions, perhaps a billion of the 7 billion people that inhabit the planet today might die for want of wheat. There are good things to say about other crops we eat, but there are very few that can carry the distinction of being essential. That essentialness is part of the reason why the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation recently provided a grant of $24 million to Cornell University to study climate change-induced heat stress and disease pathogens. A United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization study expects wheat yields to decline along with the spread of wheat pathogens due to higher temperatures and moisture. The goal of the grant is to deploy new strains of wheat that are heat tolerant as well as resistant to rust and other diseases. Why protect wheat? Because, as I said earlier, the crop provides 20% of all calories in developing and developed countries and 20% of all protein in the poorest of those. Let's consider for a moment what happened in 2008 when weather problems in the world resulted in a much depressed wheat harvest. That was the year the inventory of wheat in the world for the next year got down to around 120 million metric tons. For comparison's sake, the carryout at the end of the 2016-2017 marketing year stands at around 255 million metric tons. In 2008, and for a couple of years thereafter, it was unclear whether the world would run out of wheat. Some countries imposed embargoes on sales. The United States let price ration demand, and prices for soft white grown in the Northwest soared to more than $15 a bushel, and hard red spring wheat got up over $20 a bushel. Those countries that couldn't pay the freight had to deal with its absence, which some researchers say was one of the triggers for the revolutions that occurred throughout the Middle East in the 2010 timeframe, and especially the civil war in Syria. If the research is accurate that spikes in food prices lead to major dislocations of people and create the environments for revolution, consider this next bit of information with caution. There's 7 billion people in the world today, as I said. The population is expected to grow to 9.6 billion by 2050. That will require upping the world's food production by 70% just to avoid mass malnutrition. In other words, without adding more land to the equation, which is difficult to do since we already farm or ranch 40% of the world's land mass, we have to raise production on the same amount of land by 70%. I certainly hope agriculture is able to pull another Borlaug out of its hat. For those of you who might not know the name, Norman Borlaug is often called the father of the Green Revolution and is credited with saving millions of people from certain death by starvation by introducing semi-dwarf, high-yield, disease-resistant wheat varieties. He received the Nobel Prize in 1970. It's possible new technologies like CRISPR-Cas9, the gene editing tool, will be the next thing that saves humanity's bacon, but only if it isn't tarred by those who oppose any manipulation of plant genomes by anything but natural breeding. And the last line of the poem, "We feed you." Okay, I realize that I'm not a farmer and I don't personally feed anybody, but I work for an industry that does. The rest is literary license. All of the songs that accompany the Wheat All About It podcast, and there are 6 of them, end with the words, "We feed you." Because when all is said and done, nothing is more important than keeping people fed. And when it comes to mottos, there aren't many better. Thanks for bearing with me. I'll admit that as tough as it is to keep the treadmill rolling, I enjoy doing these podcasts. I feel less constrained about interjecting my own opinions during the podcast than when I'm writing for Wheat Life or other WGC communication vehicles. And frankly, I think those of you listening deserve to discover something different here. Who wants the same old thing? Besides, my close association with the industry basically causes me to see everything through wheat-colored glasses.
We're all children. children of a special treat. A miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread. A crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, a wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.